Good morning, Connecticut, and to our friends across the sound. It's John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Thanks for tuning in to our award-winning public affairs program for the people, bringing you even more information to help address concerns in our communities tied to youth, the economy, public health and safety, aging, education, and the environment. Well, we've got a few important dates driving today's program. First, we'll check in with an authority from St. Francis Care in recognition of November being Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Each year, more than 29,000 men will die of this disease. However, if diagnosed early, the five-year survival rate for prostate cancer is almost 100%. So we're going to talk about prevention and the warning signs you should look out for. Then we'll reach out to the thousands of Connecticut residents who are left behind following the tragedy of suicide. National Survivors of Suicide Day is celebrated November 21st, so we'll talk with representatives from both state chapters of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention about supports available to those survivors who go on following the suicide of a loved one. And we'll close visiting with representatives of the National MS Society Connecticut chapter to talk about the success of this year's benefit walks and bike events and to let you know how money raised is already helping support Connecticut families touched by multiple sclerosis. We'll be back with these segments and more on the award-winning For the People with me, John Voquette, right after this news. The importance of women making their own health care a priority will be the focus of the American Cancer Society's second annual Women Leading the Way to Wellness Breakfast on November 18th in Norwalk. The Women Leading the Way to Wellness Breakfast benefits the American Cancer Society's movement to empower Fairfield County residents, local business and community leaders, and health professionals interested in learning more about cancer prevention, early detection for women, and honoring local women who have been instrumental in the fight against cancer. For more information, call 781-420-6679 or email kara.bauer@cancer.org. So as we said in our introductory remarks, November is Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. So we're turning once again to our fantastic pool of resources, the doctors and medical professionals at St. Francis Care, welcoming Dr. David J. Grew to the program. He recently joined St. Francis Hospital and Medical Center as a radiation oncologist and is with Connecticut Radiation Oncology PC. As we kind of chatted about before he turned on the microphone, Dr. Grew received his medical degree from Tulane down in New Orleans and completed his residency at New York University School of Medicine and Radiation Oncology. So he has had the benefit of an experience of dealing with a couple of really diverse populations of individuals as he came up into his career. He's also board eligible in radiation oncology. And as we mentioned, we are talking about Prostate Cancer Awareness Month. Every year, almost 30,000 men die from this disease, and prostate cancer is the second leading cause of cancer death of U.S. men. However, as we've talked about on this program before, if diagnosed early, there's some fantastic results that can come from that. So let's start the conversation with that piece of good news, Dr. Grew. Certainly, probably even from the time you thought of going into medicine until now, the advancements in early detection survivability have really, really escalated.
Yeah, absolutely. What we see now is a lot of men going through their primary care physician to get screened, and that's either with a PSA, which is a simple blood test, or with a digital rectal exam where the prostate is actually felt by the physician to look for any nodules or anything suspicious. And we find that when we do this, we can actually detect cancer before it's spread to other areas and becomes life-threatening.
Mm-hmm. And then there's the colonoscopy, the other elephant in the room. After the digital exam, I guess that's another option?
Yeah, of course. The colonoscopy really gives us more headway in detecting colon cancers. Mm-hmm. So certainly if you have a suspicious finding as part of a prostate cancer screening in the colon, then that could be followed up with a colonoscopy. And that, you know, if you detect colon cancer early enough, then the treatment can be very effective as well.
Mm-hmm. But in terms of prostate cancer, the colonoscopy doesn't necessarily come into play.
Not as much, no. Not as much for prostate cancer. It's very effective at detecting early colon cancer, but we don't use it as much for prostate cancer.
So the ability to diagnose early, as we mentioned, is really turning out some almost perfect results.
It is. Yeah, it is. So for men who have organ-confined prostate cancer, that is disease that hasn't spread anywhere else in the body, they're going to have a lot of treatment options, ranging from surgery with potentially with a robot, non-surgical therapies, including radiation therapy, and there's also some investigational therapies that are coming on the market. Not really quite ready for widespread use, but certainly exciting areas where we hope to see a lot of spread in the future.
Mm-hmm. And there is a nearly 100% survival rate, and that extends out to about a 98% for men diagnosed early at the 10-year point, right?
Yeah, that's correct. It's really when we compare results for prostate cancer to other more aggressive cancers, prostate cancer ends up being a very gratifying disease to treat because men do extremely well with treatment. As you said, success rates are well above 90% in the best group of patients, the earliest stages. So, it's a very hopeful area for men who have a diagnosis of early stage prostate cancer.
Hmm. Now, in terms of the later stage, or when it may begin to spread, which is a game changer in terms of these high statistics, is there a kind of a uniform timeline arc of development of prostate cancer where certainly have gone undetected for a year or 5 years, there's a much greater likelihood or a certainty that it's going to spread?
No, we wish there was. What we've learned is that every patient's different. And we try to look at things like the blood tests, and we look at CAT scans and MRI results and bone scans to give us information about where exactly the cancer has spread. But these really just give us a sort of a point in time estimation of the stage of disease. We really have a lot to learn about the trajectory of a disease and how quickly it will spread in different patients. So a lot of research is going on right now in terms of trying to develop a risk stratification to figure out which men are at particularly high risk to have the disease spread to other parts of the body.
Mm. But otherwise, risk factors are quite broad.
Yes. Yeah. Exactly.
And we have talked on the program before focusing in on the more frequent incidents in the African American population.
Yeah, African American men represent a demographic that we really have to do better for them, and they tend to have a more aggressive disease and tend to have higher mortality rates as compared to white men who have the same exact diagnosis. We don't completely understand why, so we really try to encourage as many men as possible to enroll in clinical trials, and once we have the results from those trials, we'll probably get a better understanding of what exactly is driving that difference in prognosis. And once we know that, we can kind of move into the therapy side and start targeting the treatment at those areas that are causing a disparity in outcomes.
And do I have this right? Twice as many African American men will die from prostate cancer as any other individual diagnosed?
The results of studies have been somewhat variable. Mm-hmm. I would say that's kind of on the high end, but mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, it's clearly higher. The exact magnitude of the difference is probably somewhat debatable.
Okay. Well, what I'm gathering from our earlier conversation a few moments ago is that, sadly, I guess you're still seeing too many, or you and your colleagues are seeing too many cases of cancer being discovered in individuals that started out in the prostate and then spread, but it didn't really start showing up until it really started affecting other parts of the body.
Yeah, it's really unfortunate when that happens. It's not as common. By far and away, the most common situation is that men present to their doctor. They come in to their doctor when they're diagnosed. The cancer is confined to the prostate. But while it's uncommon that it has already spread to other parts of the body at the time of diagnosis, it presents a lot of challenges in terms of treatment. As I was saying earlier, at early stages, almost all treatment modalities are on the table, surgery, radiation, and other non-operative therapies. If they're diagnosed with disease that's spread to other parts of the body, unfortunately, those treatments aren't really on the table anymore, and so start to look at other kinds of treatments.
Mm-hmm. And you also mentioned the PSA and the physical test that typically happens during every gentleman's annual physical, but there also have been some concerns and questions about the PSA test. Can we delve into that just a little bit and maybe set some people's minds at ease as to whether or not it is important to get, or that it could signal, potentially false positive, or can lead folks into getting additional diagnostic situations that might not be warranted?
Absolutely, yeah. So the role of PSA for screening for prostate cancer has been somewhat controversial going back the last few decades, really. It's been the subject of investigation for two large randomized trials. One was done here in the U.S. and one was done in Europe. Unfortunately, the results of those trials showed really conflicting results, where one showed that there was a benefit and one showed that there wasn't. So that created a lot more controversy going forward. And so my opinion is that this really should be an open discussion between a man and his primary care physician or his urologist, in which the results of those trials are out on the table. And depending on the preference of that man in terms of what he would do for treatment for an early stage prostate cancer, that should really guide the discussion going forward about whether or not he should be screened and how frequently he should be screened.
Okay.
Certainly men who are in a particularly high-risk group, who have a family history of prostate cancer, who have a history of elevated PSA, these men definitely should be continued to follow and screen. And then my opinion is that, generally speaking, men should be thinking about this and kind of going forward have this ongoing discussion with their physician.
We kind of started the conversation talking about how survivability has escalated with early detection, but something else that must be fascinating to you and your other colleagues is the advancements in genetic testing. And it really seems from the research that I've done that it seems like your industry is poised for a breakthrough with genetics that could also really be a game changer in terms of, pre-deciding maybe a course of both lifestyle prevention and diagnosis and testing and things like that. For the last few minutes that we have, can you talk kind of looking into the near and maybe distant future and tell me what's happening on the front of genetic testing for prostate cancer?
Absolutely. That's a great question. So I think genetic testing is going to be a really exciting and important field in terms of cancer detection going forward. And this kind of loops back into what we were talking about before, looking at particularly vulnerable groups of people who tend to have a more aggressive type of disease. You mentioned African-American men, specifically in prostate cancer, but this really goes across all types of cancer. We need to start somehow incorporating genetic profile and genetic testing into our screening analysis. And so while we cast a very wide net in prostate cancer screening with PSA and rectal exam, if we can somehow incorporate genetic testing into that, we can kind of get a little bit smarter about identifying not just men who have prostate cancer, but men who have prostate cancer that would potentially become life-threatening. And I think that'll be the key going forward. At this time, it's genetic testing is not quite ready for prime time, for mainstream, but there's certainly a lot of ongoing studies, a lot of great work being done. And once we're able to use those studies to identify these high-risk groups, I'm sure that that information will be incorporated into the very standard recommendations by primary care doctors all over the country.
Mm. And with an eye on prevention, once a man gets to the age where he may be more susceptible to prostate cancer, is it too late to make a lifestyle change that might aid in prevention? I mean, I guess the road to prostate cancer begins with lifestyle behaviors that could begin in childhood. Is there really any way to better prevent it aside from regular screening, and especially for African American men to be much more aware of the increase in risk that they face?
You know, I think it's never too late for a lifestyle change. There's not really great data to support that. Once you have a diagnosis, that changing lifestyle necessarily improves outcomes from prostate cancer. And specifically in the lowest risk group, that group that we had talked about earlier, who have a survival in excess of 90%, it's going to be hard to ever show that you can get better than that because it's just so good on its own. Mm. But that's not to say that, you know, improving your lifestyle with healthier diet and exercise won't extend your life, not just from prostate cancer, but from any other disease, you know, heart disease, other types of cancer. I think that's a really important part of your ongoing health. And so if you can make that change once you have a diagnosis of cancer, I think you're in good shape.
And certainly starting in the recovery mode from a much better position if you're in optimal health versus, you know, facing other lifestyle-imposed health risks. So,
Excellent. Yeah, I mean, and healthy patients are the ones who are going to be most fit to tolerate any, God forbid, in the event of a recurrence, any necessary treatments that need to come down the further down the road. The healthiest, the fittest patients are going to be the ones who are best suited to get that kind of aggressive treatment that's needed to cure.
Excellent. Well, very informative conversation with Dr. David Grew. This November, Prostate Cancer Awareness Month, Dr. Grew works with the St. Francis Care Network. He also is part of Connecticut Radiation Oncology PC. We thank you for your input and great information, Dr. Grew. Great to meet you, and we hope to talk to you again. Thanks for the call. Well, as we indicated at the beginning of the program, International Survivors of Suicide Day is coming up on November 21st, and there are events happening all over Connecticut, and we're here and so pleased to be talking with the Northern Connecticut Chapter Volunteer Director for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, Tom Steen. You may recognize his voice from talking with us way back in late September ahead of a number of suicide prevention walks that were happening, the Out of the Darkness walks in Connecticut. We've got him back in studio now because we're turning our attention to folks like him, folks like myself, who are survivors and left behinders, as I describe myself, of suicide, because for everyone who commits the act of suicide, there are many, many, many left behind who have to cope with it with so often and so few resources or knowing where to go, that it's great to hear that Connecticut has such a developing, robust network of support, particularly through the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention chapters, both in Northern and Southern Connecticut. So, Tom, welcome to the program.
Thank you, John.
So, for your experience, it's still very fresh, just 4 years, the loss of your son. If you don't mind, just quickly letting us know how that situation happened.
Well, I lost my son, Tyler. He was attending college in Savannah, Georgia, and we were far away. You know, the shock and horror of hearing that your son is dead is without question the worst thing a parent can go through. The days and weeks that followed were very traumatic on both my wife and my two surviving sons. Mm-hmm. On where to go and how to get help and support. And to be quite frankly, John, there wasn't much. And so as I left the field of the YMCA and started collecting my pension, I decided to do something about it. And so I got involved and became really very entrenched in trying to prevent suicide. And it was a form of healing for me because mm-hmm. as I go out, I educate people on the risk factors and warning signs of suicide in hopes that a family doesn't have to go on the same journey that I am.
Yeah.
The other side of it is folks like you and I who are left behinders, and I do like that phrase because it's certainly that finding ways for us all to heal. Having a loss like this creates a hole in your life that never gets filled. But as a survivor, you have to find a way to heal. And for me, getting out, talking about suicide, trying to reduce the stigma connected to it is so vitally important. Mm-hmm. And by doing that, I build a bridge over my hole in my life.
Yeah,
and it's a forever building bridge.
Yeah.
And like today, I'm adding another board to that bridge.
Yeah.
In hopes that, folks can heal from the loss of suicide, but more importantly, how do we prevent it?
Yeah.
And so that's kind of been my cause and why I got so involved with the foundation, American Foundation for Suicide Prevention.
Mm. A 100% preventable tragedy. Were you in any way initially heartened to discover, if you didn't know already, that there not only was a statewide resource, not only a national resource, but literally a global focus on people like you and me who are left behind after losing a loved one?
Not until a couple of years afterwards, as I began to get more and more involved in the community and then talking about suicide and the tragedy surrounding suicide. Mm. And so as I got more involved, I found about a date that's coming up here in November called the International Suicide Advisory. Suicide Survivors Program. And this is a program that's happening worldwide, mm-hmm. all over the world, where survivors like you and I get together for 3-4 hours. We break some bread. And my event on the 21st in Hartford will be held at 200 Day Hill Road in Windsor, Connecticut. Mm-hmm. And we usually offer a light breakfast, and we have speakers who talk about their loss and how they heal. And then we break up into groups. We watch a video and really just kind of interlock arms with each other, that know that you're not alone, there is support, and let's walk that journey together.
Yeah, a little solidarity action going on.
Yes,
yeah.
Very much so.
So in the last 5 minutes or so that we have with you this morning, I want to talk right to the rest of the survivors and left behinders who might be listening, or folks who know them, not only to support driving them to one of the Connecticut chapters of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. And in fact, folks, if you're listening, AFSP.org is the website and the only initials you need to remember to begin healing and coping and getting resources and learning about prevention. AFSP for the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. That'll lead you to the Connecticut chapter in your neighborhood and the great resource and people like Tom who provide them. So Tom, you know, in my case, and for most of the folks that I know in my situation, it was this constant and intense self-blame. Everybody thought that there was something that they could have individually, never mind collectively, done to make all the difference in the world and prevent it. And I guess the hardest thing to come to grips with is the fact that, you know, perhaps none of us could have done anything about it. From your trained perspective, what are a couple of the most important things that you try to impart on survivors during those horrible, tragic, dark, bottomless days that come after?
It's really important, in my opinion, to reach out for help, to not be afraid to talk about it. And for those friends and family and supporters of a recent person who's lost somebody to suicide, not to be afraid to talk to them. I think society is like, oh, we shouldn't talk to them because that make them hurt more. And actually, it's the other way around. Person heals when family and friends and coworkers, you know, offer their condolences and stay connected. And, you know, when you lose somebody to suicide, the first few weeks you hear from a lot of people. There's, you know, there's services, and depending on your religious belief, where your loved one goes, or cemetery, what have you, services. But then you're alone. You're all alone. And so I for the folks that are listening today, that we are a society that when a tragic loss like this happens, we need to stay connected. We need to reach out and help those who have experienced a recent loss. Go to the AFSP website. There are support groups throughout our state. I think there's a dozen of them now. They're all volunteer run, and they're fellow survivors and that really just meet on a monthly basis to talk about healing and how to stay connected. We also have our two chapters in Connecticut program called the Survivor Outreach Program, which is a program where two volunteers will go to a newly lost survivor or family and speak to them, just talk about the loss, and it's okay, and we will all, and through our experiences share with them how they might think about finding ways for them to heal themselves.
It's sad to say that I think one of the things that contributes so much to the stigma is being so afraid to say the wrong thing, but there's very little wrong that you can say.
That's correct. It's really just, you know, reaching out and talking, and for my loss, my wife and I, we love to talk about Tyler because we talk about the great memories. He was a great man of 21 years, but he left us, and he left us because of his reasons, not because of anything we did. I always share with folks, you know, did you know Tyler was really in trouble? No, we didn't. He had woven a blanket of deception around him that no one could see, even his closest friends. So as we move through our days, weeks, and months, and now years of healing, we've come to realize that they were really his troubles, and for us and for me, the other folks take the different roads, but for me, I want to prevent it. I don't want folks to have to go through the same thing I'm going through.
Well, if you're out there listening and you are yourself or you know someone who's a survivor of suicide, we encourage you to celebrate International Survivors of Suicide Day, including the event coming up in Hartford on November 21st. Tom is running it, and it's all part of the national initiative under the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, the two Connecticut chapters, and the many international networks that are all working in concert to try to rid not only our state and our nation, but our entire world of this 100% preventable tragedy that is suicide. From the perspective of a suicide survivor myself and our guest Tom Steen this morning of the Northern Connecticut chapter of AFSP, we thank you for being part of the program this morning, Tom, and for your great information. And once again, our sympathies to you and your family on your loss. Do you love Connecticut? If you do, there are hundreds of nonprofit agencies, community groups, and grassroots causes that would love to have your support. You can learn about many of them through LoveCT. Just go to our radio station website, hit the event guide tab, and click on to LoveCT to help the many causes supported by Connoisseur Media. I'm Director of Public Affairs, John Voquette. We'll be back to the award-winning For the People right after this news. Connecticut NOFA's Whole Farm Planning Certificate course is designed to help the 68% of new farmers who didn't grow up on a farm realize the farm of their dreams. The state's Northeast Organic Farming Association is accepting applications through November 21st for the program starting December 5th. This 10-week intensive Whole Farm Planning Certificate course provides new and aspiring farmers with the classroom and hands-on training they need to plan and manage successful farm businesses. For additional course information, contact CT NOFA at 203-308-2584 or just visit ctnofa.org. We're now joined by Jania Padilla. She is with the Southern Connecticut chapter of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention and the founder of the Sergeant Walter Padilla Memorial Foundation. Jania, welcome to the program and thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me, John.
First of all, for folks that may have joined us while we were talking to your Northern Connecticut colleague, we want to remind them that International Survivors of Suicide Day can change your life. It's one day a year when people affected by suicide loss gather around the globe at events in local communities to find comfort and gain understanding as they share stories of healing and hope. Survivors Day 2015 is happening Saturday, November 21st, and we would like to remind folks that there are places to go here in Connecticut to gather with others as we kind of unofficially dubbed us all kind of left behinders, as I am and as is our guest Jania. So Jania, welcome to the program. Thanks for coming down and getting on the line with us.
Thank you for inviting me.
So let's talk a little bit about some of the things that you have found are helpful to survivors of suicide in your experience. And then we'll talk a little bit about the Memorial Foundation. For folks who are paying attention and know that Saturday, November 21st is Survivor Day, what's the easiest place for them to go to learn about activities or somewhere they can go on that day?
Well, for the Survivor's Day program sponsored by AFSP, you can go to afsp.org. Here in Connecticut, for Southern Connecticut, our event will be at the Fairfield Museum and History Center at 30 Beach Road in Fairfield, and it's from 12 to 4.
Excellent. So let's talk a little bit about your situation, Jania. Tell us your story and what has infused you with such passion to not only represent half of the state with the AFSP, but also to establish a foundation of your own.
Well, my brother Walter was in the Army, and he returned from Iraq in 2005, and he was not okay. He had post-traumatic stress, but you know, we thought he was doing okay with it. I mean, he was a very vibrant, artistic young man, very popular, very, you know, loving. He was a funny guy. So we thought he had it well under control, and he took his life on April 1st of 2007, and we were all surprised and devastated. My family continues to deal with the ramifications of his death, and in my search for healing, it was in connecting with other survivors of suicide loss that I really found my own voice. I really did not want to have other families go through what my family had was going through, and I found that my friends, you know, as loving and as gentle as they were with me, really didn't have a way of connecting with me around suicide. So I discovered the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and I went to my first Survivors of Suicide Day event, and it was life-changing. Just being able to be with other people who had gone through what I had gone through and be able to mourn with them helped me see that continuing on was still possible, that even though we were left behind, we could still move forward, if that makes sense.
Absolutely.
So I became involved with AFSP, and I have been ever since.
The you kind of touch on an interesting phenomena that happens, I would imagine, with a lot of people when they're suddenly faced with the news or the call that a loved one has committed suicide. Everything goes internal. Somewhere in your head, you know that there's millions of other people that have been through that. At some point, that realization has to hit. But the idea about seeking out others that have been through it, it is hard to find sometimes. And it's incredible that you were able to find it and then turn it into such an incredible effort and means of support for others. But the other thing that you pointed out that's really important is how awkward and troubling it is for friends and coworkers and neighbors and loved ones who have not been touched by suicide to be able to come forward and try to be comforting or say the right thing or do the right thing, because that empathy factor is so critically important, as you've discovered.
Yes, and I find too that with any unexpected death, the grieving process is already complicated, but suicide is its own special type of hell, mourning a suicide death, because you're left feeling guilty. And, you know, you're wondering what did you miss? What could you have done? And the anger. I know a lot of survivors don't feel comfortable talking about the anger. I certainly felt a strong anger towards my brother. And I went through my own internal process of having to forgive him and having to forgive myself. And that's not something a lot of people want to really get involved with, because it is so personal.
Yeah.
And I think when you meet with other survivors and you can actually tell your story and you can say those things, I was angry, I'm angry. I felt that he shouldn't have done that. I felt that he let us down. You can't say those things to the general public, because then they wonder what's wrong with you.
Yeah.
But another survivor understands, because they felt it too.
Yeah. So out of this terrible tragedy and experience with your brother, as we said, you not only found and then became a leader with the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, but you also found a way to help honor him and maybe at the same time provide a resource to folks who may, like him, come out of some type of military service that may have in some way have contributed to suicidal thoughts by establishing the Sergeant Walter Padilla Memorial Foundation. Tell us a little bit about that and how that is working.
Okay, so it's an information repository. I have a lot of veterans who contact me because the conventional methods of treating post-traumatic stress aren't working, and they are literally at their wits' end. So I connect them to complementary and alternative approaches to post-traumatic stress. So instead of, you know, here's the name of a therapist, here's the name of, you know, psychiatrist you can see. I've connected people to let's get a free, you know, get a service dog. There's a retreat going on for 2 weeks in Peru. Would you be interested in going to something like that? And I can tell you that overwhelmingly the response has been positive. I connect them to earth-centered therapy where they go kind of work on a farm for a month and just integrate their trauma. So for a lot of these folks who come back who conventional medicine doesn't help, they find this human-centered kind of centered approach much more helpful.
That's great. So before we bid you farewell and once again remind folks that there are resources for you if you know of someone who is even talking about or you think is contemplating suicide, your law enforcement and emergency responders in your own community are trained and able to deal with it from the dispatcher on down to those responders by calling 911. If you think you may need some assistance or support yourself as a survivor or someone who's a survivor of or a loved one of an individual who's attempted suicide, you can go through 211 info line, or you can reach out to the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention, and especially for those survivors who are looking for someone else to talk to, maybe a place to find relief, as Jania did on November 21st, or any day you can get in touch with the AFSP. Jania, one more time, if we could get the website or any other resource numbers or addresses, I'd like to share that one more time.
Sure, it's www.afsp.org. You will find a listing there for the Survivor Days, for support groups, as well as upcoming community walks. And John, just a quick addendum to what you said about being concerned. If you are concerned about someone who you know who may be having thoughts of suicide, have the conversation with them. Okay. Oftentimes, I deal with a lot of folks who have thoughts, and they say that, you know, thank you for asking the question. I feel the relief was immediate. So I know it can be daunting and very scary, but to ask someone if they're having thoughts of suicide and letting them know that you care is often very effective.
Mm. It is the main component, the first question essentially you ask in the course of mental health first aid, you know, to be able to establish a baseline for where that individual might be at that you're encountering. Certainly asking that question can in some ways, I guess, really make the change for the individual who's considering it to just kind of, you know, have the mirror held up to them. So I appreciate that final point, Jania. And I wish you best of luck. I'll be thinking about you on November 21st and all the other folks that we've had the pleasure of meeting through our association with you and both the Southern and Northern Connecticut chapters of the American Foundation for Suicide Prevention. Best of luck with your foundation. And hopefully we'll be able to talk to you again soon to continue this this outreach and education. Thanks for being part of the program. So anyone who might have gone out to any of the MS bike events or walk events has certainly seen our radio stations represented. We love being a partner with the Multiple Sclerosis Society Connecticut chapter, National Multiple Sclerosis Society Connecticut chapter, I should say. And we are in studio today with Jacqueline Sembor and Cynthia Bitterini, both communication specialists. Jacqueline is a senior specialist and Cynthia is associate vice president of communications for the National MS Society Connecticut chapter. So we're going to do some looking back and looking forward and also taking a few minutes to remind people about where the money goes and how the outreach and support works when you participate, whether you were on a team or a team captain or you biked and got others to do it. Every dollar that you earned helped the cause, and it's pretty exciting to be involved with for folks that may have been longtime listeners. I had a loved one who lived with MS more than 30 years, and these folks at the National MS Society always were able resources with great information. So we want to share that with the thousands of families that might be within the sound of our voice who are also dealing with that diagnosis, or with an individual who may have been diagnosed some time ago who haven't yet started to take advantage of the resources. So ladies, welcome to the program and thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
First of all, let's look back on 2015. You're sort of in that lull period where you're kind of celebrating the successes but also gearing up and planning for 2016. Let's look back first and talk a little bit about where you folks stand right now as a result of all of the great volunteerism that came together to benefit the chapter.
Sure. We had a fabulous turnout for our Walk MS events in 2015 in the spring. We raised over $1.4 million to help support families with multiple sclerosis, and it was one big party after another, and I think folks came out, they had a great time, they felt the energy, they felt excited about being able to really help those people who have the disease.
Yeah, the thing that was awesome for me at the Litchfield event was not just all the folks who are rallying around with shirts or banners and placards representing the person that they were walking or running for, but so many people that have MS come out to these events and participate. You had bikers with multiple sclerosis and walkers, whether they were walking themselves or being pushed in a wheelchair. There were a lot of participation and inspiration from folks that were touched by multiple sclerosis.
The one big thing that we love to share with our audience and everybody who comes out to our events is to be sure that they recognize that we specifically choose all of those locations to be fully accessible. So somebody who does need to use a cane or a walker or has a power wheelchair or needs to be pushed, they can participate. There's no barriers at the locations that we choose for them, because we want them to feel like a loved member of our community. They can participate, they can come out, they can be there, they can experience it. And even if they don't want to participate in the walk and go those 2.5 or 5 mile routes, they can stay at the finish line, they can cheer people on, they can volunteer, they can hang out with the wonderful folks from the radio stations. There's always something going on, a lot of festivities and things to do. So we invite everybody to come out and just be a part of it and see what we have to offer.
Yeah. And the great thing about these events that MS hosts throughout the state of Connecticut, they happen at various times. Nobody's calendar is so full that they can't target one of the dates, even if they've got to travel a little bit to participate. And you do provide a great variety of things people could do. And these are the individuals that like doing that strategic kind of one-off philanthropy, but there are also a lot of opportunities for volunteerism year-round, even if you're somebody who knows nobody who's been touched by multiple sclerosis, right?
Absolutely. We have people who come into the office and volunteer for us to help us do some administrative work. People can volunteer at some of these large events. We also have a number of people who participate in the do-it-yourself fundraising events, where they might have a family member or they themselves may have multiple sclerosis and they want to do something and they want to volunteer in that respect. So they might hold a big party or a dinner, or we had one fellow who kayaked across the Sound, and all in that same spirit and effort to help raise money for MS.
And you folks do a great job enlisting corporate sponsorship as well, which is a critical partner in Connecticut.
Absolutely. We have, for a walk, we've had Travelers, who has been our title sponsor for years, and we really couldn't do these events without them. And Praxair has been a wonderful sponsor for our bike event.
Excellent. So looking forward with the short lens, are you folks indeed done for the year? And what's left in store for folks before we start looking forward to a full schedule of planned events for 2016?
Sure. So before we finish out this year, we actually have a very large gala that's taking place next Thursday in Stamford. Speaking of corporate sponsorship, it's a gala that will recognize Margaret Keane, who's the president and CEO of Synchrony Financial down in Stamford. She has really rallied her troops and her employees, and they've reached out to their networks. And it's going to be the largest gala we've ever had, thanks to her and her network and all of the support who's really behind her. And that'll be, like I said, next Thursday.
Next Thursday, the 19th,
down in Stamford. And after that, it really is preparing for Walk MS, which will be in April. That's our next huge event. Before that, obviously, March is MS Awareness Month. And we'll have MS Awareness Week nestled within that, and we'll have our State Action Day, where all of our activists and legislators will be at the state capitol meeting and sharing our priorities for the year. So we have a lot of stuff going on. We have programs, we have services, we have advocacy, and we have fundraising, but we really try to span the gamut and come at MS from all sides.
Excellent. Well, let's review for the folks who may be opening up their calendars and getting ready for 2016. The first event on the schedule is at Jennings Beach in Fairfield on April 16th. Then the next day, Sunday, April 17th, there's one at Camp Harkness in Waterford, at Cheshire High School, a huge event in Cheshire, at the University of Connecticut West Hartford campus, and in Simsbury at the Westminster School. These are all walks, or are these a mixture of walks and bikes?
Those are all walks, yep. So that first weekend is all walk, and then we'll have we are a beneficiary of the Ion Bank Cheshire Half Marathon, which actually takes place on April 24th. So we will have a team of runners the week following the first walk. So we'll have walk, and then we'll have run, and then we'll go right back to walk.
Okay, and that's Cove Island Park in Stamford on Saturday, April 30th, and at Rentschler Field in East Hartford also on that same day, Saturday, April 30th. And then the next day, Sunday, May 1st, at the Litchfield Town Green, where I'm hoping to return to help with that event, and at the same time in West Haven at West Haven High School. So we're looking at April 16th and 17th, and April 30th and May 1st. And how about for the bikes?
For bike is always in June, so it'll be Sunday, June
5th,
which is in Windsor at Griffinland. Mm-hmm. They've been our host for many, many years. We have a kiddie ride, we have a 10-mile ride, 25, 50, all the way up to a 100-mile ride. And then we will do it all over again Sunday, June 12th, down in Norwalk at Longshore Pavilion at the Cove.
And these bike rides are great. They really are mapped out to provide not only a semi-challenging course at the highest level, but also incorporate, whether it's in the northern, northeastern part of the state, up in the hills or out on the coast in Norwalk. It's a great opportunity for folks that want to get behind the wheel of their bikes, whether they're fledgling riders that want to do a short course, or the hardcore folks that want to go up to 100 miles, a great opportunity. So they can all gain access to registrations and team formation support at which website?
They can go to our website, which is ctfightsms.org.
Excellent.
And they can link on to information about walk and bike and any other of our events.
Excellent. In the last few minutes that we have then, let's take it one step further and talk about some of the different ways that the National MS Society Connecticut and its chapters throughout the country are utilizing funds raised at all these events to then turn it around back to the community, supporting individuals and families with multiple sclerosis. What are a couple of the most popular support programs or initiatives that you guys are mounting that seem to really resonate and draw folks? I'm sure you can't count the amount of times you've heard people say, boy, I wish I knew that this service was available or the support was available sooner, right?
Right. No, absolutely. We offer a wide variety of programs for not only the individuals that are living with MS, but for their families, because multiple sclerosis is a disease that affects not only the individual, but the entire family. We have support group programs. We have programs for those who are newly diagnosed. Every year we offer scholarships to students who are diagnosed with MS, or they have a parent who has been diagnosed with MS, and we're very proud to support those students. So many different programs. I think one of the most popular is Vacation Week, which we hold, and it really enables individuals who have MS to be able to go out and enjoy a week of vacation time, and they wouldn't be able to do that on their own. So the MS Society is critical in helping those people get that little bit of R&R that they so deserve and enjoy year in and year out.
Excellent. So access to those resources and many ideas about fundraising, including ways to sign up yourself or your team for either the walk or the bike or several of them, all once again at this website?
ctfightsms.org. Absolutely. There's a calendar listing on there, links to all of our fundraising events, and programs and services that we offer.
Excellent. Wrapping up the program with our friend Jacqueline Sembor and a brand new friend to the program, Cynthia Bitterini, both representing the National MS Society Connecticut chapter. Thanks, guys, for being part of the program this morning.
Thank you.
You've been listening to our award-winning public affairs program, For the People. The opinions expressed on this broadcast represent those of our guests and host and do not necessarily represent the views of Connoisseur Media. If you have a suggestion for a guest, an issue, or a community calendar item relevant to the audiences and communities we serve, you must make your request for consideration in writing via email to me at john.voquette@connoisseurct.com. We do not accept pitches or requests for coverage by phone. Remember, no part of this program may be copied, disseminated, or rebroadcast. Our public file reflecting the full scope of our station's responsiveness to critical issues in the communities we serve can be viewed upon request weekdays during normal business hours at 869 Blue Hills Avenue in Bloomfield. Our theme music is by Rick Miller and Scott's, with original music by Noel Vayette. I'm John Voquette, Director of Public Affairs for Connoisseur Media. Join us again at this time next week for another installment of the award-winning For the People, or listen to this and other For the People podcasts under the podcast tab at our radio station website or on iTunes. Until this time next week, thanks for listening.
Organized and save big money with Dakota Closets at Menards. Dakota Closets can be installed in any room, from home offices and laundry rooms to walk-in or reach-in closets. Use the You Create Closet Planner, available in-store or online, to design a Dakota closet system that maximizes your space and matches your style. Plus, check out our weekly flyer on Menards.com for more great deals happening this week.
Save big money at Menards. Hi, everybody. It's Andy and James here from your next favorite podcast, No Such Thing as a Fish.
That's right. We do fun facts.
Yes, we do. James, give me a fact.
Did you know that there is an extinct bandicoot whose official scientific name is Crash Bandicoot?
Lovely. I didn't know that. Did you know, James, that Upper Egypt is technically below Lower Egypt?
Incredible. Absolutely amazing. I would love to hear more about that.
Well, all you have to do is go and listen to No Such Thing as a Fish.
Where will I find it?
Oh, all over.
Okay, bye.
Bye.